Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome. I'm Tracy McClure with you for a special half-hour-long program on Pope Benedict XVI's apostolic journey to Turkey. Thanks for joining me. Christian unity is an urgent mission for the Catholic and Orthodox churches. That was Pope Benedict's message Thursday from Turkey, a nation which itself bridges the East and West. On his third and next to last day of his pastoral visit there, Pope Benedict participated at the Orthodox celebration of the Divine Liturgy, presided by Patriarch Bartholomew I at the Patriarchal Church of St. George in Istanbul for the Feast of St. Andrew. While Philippa Hitchin is in Istanbul with Pope Benedict, I talked with her shortly after the liturgy ended.
Benedicat vos omnipotens Deus, Pater et Filius et Spiritus Sanctus.
Και η αγάπη του Θεού και Πατρός και η κοινωνία του Αγίου Πνεύματος ή με τα πάντων ημών.
So, Philippa, watching the celebration on television, it seemed very impressive. Afterwards, when the Pope and Patriarch Bartholomew appeared on the balcony, they shook hands, they looked so pleased, they even raised their hands, almost in a sign of victory. It seemed to me a very symbolic gesture for what was a very symbolic liturgy.
Yes, that's right, Tracy. Really, Thursday's events here in Istanbul mark the main focus of Pope Benedict's pastoral journey to Turkey, and that is to strengthen and improve these relations between the Catholic and the Orthodox churches. And so in the morning, the Pope returned to that Patriarchal Church of St. George, where he'd been welcomed by Patriarch Bartholomew I the previous evening, and he took part in the lengthy but beautiful Divine Liturgy marking the feast day of St. Andrew, of course, patron saint of the Orthodox world.
Well, in fact, Philippa, November 30th marks the feast of St. Andrew, as you were saying. He, of course, is the apostle revered by the Orthodox, just as we Catholics revere St. Peter. But just who was St. Andrew? Just listen and we'll find out.
St. Andrew the Apostle was born in Bethsaida of Galilee. He was the brother of Simon, called Peter, the first bishop of Rome. Andrew at once recognized Jesus as the Messiah, and it was Andrew who introduced Jesus to his brother Peter. Early Christian writers say that Andrew preached in Byzantium, where he appointed St. Stachys as its first bishop. Andrew is therefore venerated as the founder of the church at the city that became Constantinople and later Istanbul. Andrew received martyrdom by crucifixion on the order of the Roman governor Aegeus. The place of Andrew's crucifixion was at Patrae in Achaia, during the reign of Nero, on the 30th of November in the year 60. Andrew was bound, not nailed to the cross, in order to prolong his sufferings. A centuries-old tradition has it that the cross of Andrew's crucifixion had the form of an X, and the X-shaped cross is now widely known as the St. Andrew's Cross. Both the Latin and the Greek churches keep the 30th of November as his feast.
Now, Philippa, back to you. I know that over recent decades, since the Second Vatican Council, it's become traditional for Catholic and Orthodox delegations to make exchange visits to Rome and Istanbul.
That's absolutely right. They make these exchange visits to celebrate each other's feast days. And in fact, if you remember, Pope John Paul II came here to Istanbul on November the 30th, 1979, right at the beginning of his pontificate.
In the same spirit, my presence here today is meant to renew our commitment to advancing along the road towards the re-establishment by God's grace of full communion between the Church of Rome and the Church of Constantinople. I can assure you that the Catholic Church is willing to do everything possible to overcome obstacles and to seek, together with our Orthodox brothers and sisters, even more effective means of pastoral cooperation to this end.
In fact, in his words at the liturgy in St. George's on Thursday, Pope Benedict gave thanks for these many really positive developments that have taken place since Pope Paul VI and Patriarch Athenagoras took the vital step back in December 1965 of lifting the mutual anathemas or excommunications that were proclaimed in 1054 when the Church divided into East and Western Christianity.
In fact, Philippa, I'd like to take a look now at exactly what divided the two churches back in the 1050s. Of the several issues the two churches could not agree on, one stood out from the rest. Let's listen.
An especially thorny issue was the proper understanding of the Holy Spirit's relation to the Father and the Son within the mysterious life of the Most Holy Trinity. After centuries of struggle with the question, Ecumenical Patriarch Michael Carularius openly and definitively declared that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father. The Patriarch's declaration was understood to be at odds with the traditional Western understanding of the Holy Trinity, according to which the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. The Filioque controversy, so called because Filioque is one way to say and the Son in Latin, led the Pope to declare excommunicate and anathema all those professing the belief formerly espoused by the Patriarch. The Patriarch also declared excommunicate and anathema all those professing Filioque. The year was 1054. After more than 9 centuries of separation, in December 1964, Pope Paul VI and the Ecumenical Patriarch Athenagoras met in Jerusalem, bringing new vitality to the relationship between the churches that had been sadly divided for so long. On December 7, 1965, the Pope and the Patriarch lifted the mutual excommunications.
So, Philippa, what else did Pope Benedict have to say with regard to Christian unity at Thursday's liturgy?
Pope Benedict said, just as Jesus calls the two brothers, Andrew and Peter, to be fishers of men, so the successors of these apostles, the Pope and the Patriarch today, are called to the same and ever more urgent task of spreading the gospel and promoting its traditions and values.
This charge left us by the holy brothers Peter and Andrew is far from finished. On the contrary, today it is more urgent and necessary, for it looks not only to those cultures which have been touched only marginally by the gospel message, but also to long-established European cultures deeply grounded in the Christian tradition.
He noted that the divisions which persist among Christians today are in fact a scandal and an obstacle to the proclamation of that gospel.
The divisions which exist among Christians are a scandal to the word and an obstacle to the proclamation of the gospel. It is only through brotherly communion between Christians and through their mutual love that the message of God's love for each and every man and woman will become credible. Anyone who casts a realistic glance on the Christian world today will see the urgency of this witness. May our daily prayer and activity be inspired by a fervent desire not only to be present at the Divine Liturgy, but to be able to celebrate it together, to take part in the one table of the Lord, sharing the same bread and the same chalice. May our encounter today serve as an impetus and joyful anticipation of the gift of full communion.
And very importantly, he renewed the invitation issued by his predecessor, Pope John Paul II, to promote a sincere dialogue to discover new ways in which the Petrine ministry, this is another obstacle which divides the two churches, the Petrine ministry can be exercised in a sincere service of love, which is recognized by all concerned.
Now, Philippa, I know the two church leaders signed a joint declaration at the end of Thursday's liturgy. What was contained in that document?
Well, this document really contains much of the same desire to push ahead in this ecumenical dialogue between Orthodox and Catholics. The statement was signed by the Pope and the Patriarch after the liturgy in the adjoining residence of Patriarch Bartholomew.
Déclaration commune entre le Pape Benoît XVI et le Patriarche Bartholomeus I.
The statement read aloud in French, first of all, by the head of the Vatican's Council for Christian Unity, Cardinal Walter Kasper, stressed especially the vital work of the Mixed Commission on Theological Dialogue, which met recently in Belgrade. This is a commission of Orthodox and Catholic theologians, which is seeking to resolve some of these main obstacles we've been talking about that are still dividing the two churches. For the third time in 3 days here in Istanbul, the statement also raised the plight of people in the Middle East, calling for peace in the land where Jesus lived, and especially calling for a really more authentic dialogue between people of different faiths in order to fight against violence and discrimination. And above all, the statement reiterated the shared belief that killing innocent people in the name of religion is an offense to God, it said, and an offense to human dignity. The statement also said that both Catholic and Orthodox leaders view in a positive way the developments regarding the formation of the European Union, stressing that all efforts must be made to protect religious freedom, to safeguard the rights and traditional practices of ethnic and religious minorities. And it said Europe, while remaining open to other religions, really must preserve its profoundly Christian roots, traditions, and values.
In the face of this reality, we are called, together with all other Christian communities, to renew Europe's awareness of its Christian roots, traditions, and values, giving them new vitality. Our efforts to build closer ties between the Catholic Church and the Orthodox churches are part of this missionary task.
And my thanks to Philippa Hitchin for reporting there from Istanbul. But just what are some of the challenges facing the ecumenical dialogue between Eastern and Western churches? Archbishop Demetrios of the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese of America is spokesman for the Patriarchate in Istanbul during Pope Benedict's visit. He calls the Pope's decision to make the trip, despite threats to his life, a daring expression of love towards the goal of Christian unity.
This meeting, because of the conditions and the daring and bold step that it signifies, it has an increasing impact on creating this climate, as we say, of more trust, more willingness, more softening of some sort, some strong and sharp lines, this type of thing.
Pope Benedict has, of course, stressed that the search for unity is one of the most important aspects of his pontificate. Mm-hmm. How important is this ecumenical journey, this search for unity? How important is it to most people within the Orthodox world, do you think?
I think it's a basic thing for people who are familiar with the basics of the gospel. The demand by the Lord Christ for unity, and unity that it's important because the unity there, Christ speaks about the Christians being one as we, you Father and myself, are one. It's a strong theological basis for unity. And then also he emphasized the fact that through the unity, the glory and the truth of God would be proclaimed. So this is a sine qua non factor in the proclamation of the Christian gospel today. You cannot really, being divided, have the full strength that the gospel has. So this, for people who are Christians and feel the command of the Lord, it's a very strong thing. Now, they are aware of a separation for almost 1,000 years. This cannot be done. Some over-optimistic people, a little bit naive thinkers, they say, oh, let's have a dialogue and we finish. We don't finish with a dialogue. We need considerable time. We need, and for theologians, we need an engagement, a strong engagement in a serious dialogue, which will produce results. We have this experience in the States. In the States, the dialogue between Roman Catholics and Orthodox never stopped, in contradistinction to what happened to the international dialogue. Never stopped. Now, it not only never stopped, it produced results. There is a very, very nice document on the Filioque, which shows a very clear progress, theologically speaking, in facing a theological issue which has been central in the division of the two churches. They also issued other statements about baptism, validity of sacraments. So that shows that with a systematic, persistent, honest work, results could come. Therefore, we think that this is now something in the minds of the Orthodox people, something that raises the expectation of more systematic, more persisting, and therefore more hope-producing dialogue among the churches.
You've touched on some of the theological questions which have traditionally divided the Roman Catholic and the Orthodox world. What do you see really as the most serious, outstanding obstacles on this ecumenical journey?
We could say we have three level of references here in obstacles. One are the obstacles of purely theological nature. One of them is the Filioque, for instance, the teaching about the Holy Spirit. There might be some Mariological issues, the Immaculate Conception, although this is a debatable theological issue, it's not like the Filioque, but yet it is something. You might also have some understandings about the specifics in the sacraments. Number two, level two, is the ecclesiological level, the primacy of the Pope, the infallibility of the Pope. For the Orthodox understanding, the supreme governance of the Church is conciliar, is the synod, is all the bishops convening in the Holy Spirit and working together. And whatever the issue, then becomes the infallible. It's not the one person pronouncing. So here is what we call ecclesiology, deals with the nature of the administration of the Church, the way the Church proceeds in pronouncing and explaining, interpreting the truths of the Gospel. And there is a third level of issues, more practical and more visible. And this is the existence of the Unitism. The Unitism, which became a strong issue after the change in Eastern Europe. This was before that, we know that. But after the change, it became a pronounced issue. In fact, it caused the stopping of the dialogue, in essence. It was one of the major issues, because all of a sudden they said, what are we talking here about dogmatics and other things? Here we have a burning issue like this, and unless we have something, clear steps here on the part of the Roman Catholic Church, said the Orthodox representation, we cannot really continue. So it was a serious issue, and still is. And it's something that is, in a way, it causes internal, sometimes, might cause internal problems, even within the Roman Catholicism. When you have, for instance, in the Uniate Church, a following of the Byzantine liturgical practices, that's one thing. They recognize the Pope as the authority, but they have married clergy. If married clergy exists within the Roman Catholic Church, then marriage or celibacy is not an absolute thing. You can imagine how this goes to the depth of the foundations of some ecclesiological positions, like the eternal nature of priestly celibacy. They say, what eternal relation? I mean, if you have the units, this is not at all absolute. Not to talk about the Orthodox Church, which is an example of this rule. There is not a rule in existence.
You're talking about these political, historical differences that have been the reason behind this fracturing in the Christian community. But as you say, this weakens our witness to the gospel today.
Absolutely.
What gives you most hope?
There is a need here. The need is imperative. It's not simply a need. It's an urgency. In fact, some people would say it's an emergency. So my hope is that exactly because of the major problems that we face today, that we will increase also our way of cooperation, and without forgetting that beyond the practical reasons and the reasons of love and charity and pain, we have also the permanent non-stopping command of the Lord that we have to be one.
Metropolitan Archbishop Demetrios is spokesman for the Patriarchate in Istanbul during Pope Benedict's visit. Well, Pope Benedict was also the third pope in modern times to visit Hagia Sophia, now a museum, but formerly a Christian Byzantine basilica that rivaled the architectural splendor of St. Peter's. It later became a mosque under Ottoman rule. Just as his predecessors, Paul VI and John Paul II, did before him, Pope Benedict was given a tour of Hagia Sophia and signed the Golden Book there, which dignitaries are invited to sign when visiting the building. Well, to find out more about the extraordinary history and architecture of Hagia Sophia, I spoke to Elizabeth Lev, a professor of Christian art and architecture at Duquesne University's Rome campus.
Hagia Sophia is an interesting reflection of an area of the world that has lived a very troubled history and a very dramatic history. In many ways, the Church of Hagia Sophia has seen things that the Basilica of St. Peter's hasn't. The church was originally built by Constantine as part of his great rebuilding program after the legalization of Christianity, and it was consecrated in 360, but it was destroyed in riots in 404 and promptly rebuilt in 415. But shortly thereafter, in yet another riot, 532, the church was devastated again. And this time, the Emperor Justinian decided to rebuild the church, not just as another church, not just as a rebuild, but he was going to build it as a showcase of this new capital, this beautiful city, Constantinople. And it was built in 5 years, which is extremely quickly, and it ended up being one of the great architectural wonders of early Christianity.
What do we see when we go in there today?
Well, today you see the church as a museum. You see the marks and the numerous marks of what has happened to this church over the years. The inauguration of Justinian's Basilica, which was December 27, 527, began a period of many, many trials. The dome collapsed twice in the 500s alone. And then the church was occupied in 1204 by the Crusaders. And for a span of about 50 years, it became a Roman Catholic cathedral. And it was consequently sacked, and many beautiful things and objects were removed. But in 1453, Constantinople fell to the Ottoman Turks, and the Church of Hagia Sophia was turned into a mosque. And because of the prohibition of images, human figures as images in the Muslim religion, the fabulous mosaics that had formed a shimmering skin on the inside of this basilica were covered with big plaster panels. And then medallions were added at a later point with verses of the Quran written on them. And so today, when you walk into this space, which in the end was secularized in 1935 and just became a museum, you walk into what is a tourist attraction with the remnants of its time as an Islamic center for prayer and the remnants of its time as a Christian church, but now just an empty buy a ticket and visit space.
But many of these panels, the mosaics, which were covered up with plaster, the plaster has been removed so people can actually see some of the mosaics.
You can see some traces of the mosaics. However, there have been the creation of some of the plaster panels that covered the original mosaics were actually taken down during the years of Turkish occupation, and the mosaics underneath were repaired. So some of those medallions are still visible. But the seal ceiling, Pantocrator, was damaged considerably. So you have some images of a program of, you know, Christ and the apostles and the angels, plus this, you know, fabulous shimmering decoration on the arcades. But the original program, the original vision, is gone.
Nonetheless, it's very significant that during the Muslim period, they did not destroy the images. They merely covered them over.
The Church of Hagia Sophia had a tremendous impact on the Muslim conquerors. They took as a model Hagia Sophia, and the greatest of the Muslim architects, who was Coca Sinan, and he lived right around the same time as Michelangelo, surprisingly enough. They're both 16th century architects. His works built in Istanbul, they are all modeled after the Hagia Sophia. And so this tremendous influence that the church had on them, that there would be a respect towards the beauty of the church, although the decorations themselves were offensive to the religious sentiment of the Ottomans.
If Hagia Sophia was a marvel of early Christian architecture, it is mirrored by the Blue Mosque, which faces it on the same Istanbul Esplanade. In a sign of respect for his Islamic hosts, Pope Benedict also paid a visit there Thursday. Susie Hodges looks at the significance the Blue Mosque has for Turkish Muslims and how some are looking at the Pope's visit there. Pope's visit to the Blue Mosque in Istanbul was a late addition to his itinerary of his visit to Turkey. The Blue Mosque is probably the city's most famous landmark and is the only mosque in Turkey with 6 minarets. It was commissioned by Sultan Ahmed I at the start of the 17th century, and its name comes from the hand-painted blue tiles used to decorate its interior. Zeynep Özbek is a Turkish student studying at Rome's Pontifical Gregorian University. She told me that symbolic gestures like the Pope's visit to this mosque often speak louder than words.
Unfortunately, both Christians and Muslims do not have a true, genuine knowledge of each other, and they always rely on what is presented in the media. And so those kinds of gestures and visits are more important than some declarations or some meetings, some official occasions. So majority of the Muslims in Turkey are interested in his visits of the Blue Mosque rather than what is put forth by the Catholic Church in the documents.
So do you think they will see it as a sign of respect?
Sure. It will be regarded as a sign of respect and as a sign of good intention in the relationship between Muslims and Christians.
Now, tell us something about the Blue Mosque. Very briefly describe it and tell us why it's so important for Muslims in Turkey.
It is just the opposite Hagia Sophia, which is a museum now, neither a mosque nor a church. It is almost as big as Hagia Sophia, and it is one of the most important mosques. It is the mosque which is visited most in Istanbul by the tourists because it has beautiful calligraphy works on the walls, and it is constructed in Ottoman times, and Muslims come together for prayer 5 times a day.
That was Zeynep Özbek, a Turkish student. And I'm Susie Hodges.
And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.